This Star News Media podcast is presented by North Chase Family Dentistry. Open evenings, Saturdays, and they probably take your insurance. Visit them on the web at northchasefamilydentistry.com. And by Tide Water Heating and Air Conditioning, servicing all major brands with highly trained technicians who are the best the industry has to offer, serving Wilmington and surrounding communities for more than 40 years. Learn more at TidewaterAC.com.
And by Cape Fear Pharmacy, a local independent pharmacy providing healthcare and compounding services customized to meet our patients' needs. Visit CapeFearPharmacy.com today and let us take care of you.
As the sun rose on the morning of November 10th, 1898, Wilmington was a city on edge. Few of its residents had slept a wink the night before, knowing full well the demands and threats that had been issued by one side of the community to the other, all with a deadline that was fast approaching. 33 years had passed since the end of the Civil War. And in that time, Wilmington had become an example of the progress that could be achieved in the New South through Reconstruction, even as the country itself struggled to mend its deep divides. During this period of prosperity in Wilmington, black men held public office, black families had thriving businesses, and black laborers were the backbone of the local workforce. But even in a city that seemed as though it could be a place of opportunity for all, some of its most powerful white residents, who could still remember a time before the war when they held dominion over everything and everyone, began to push back on the growing promise of a diverse future. At first, they worked to suppress the black community through intimidation on the streets and at the ballot box, at a time when only men were given the right to vote. In this new era for Wilmington, the black community saw a vision of opportunity for itself that its ancestors could have only dreamed of. But at the same time, some of those in the white community saw it all as a challenge to their self-ascribed supremacy, a right with which they believed their maker had endowed them and their ancestors. To assert their dominance, they set out on a campaign of white supremacy, of which they spoke openly and proudly. In the fall of 1898, on the cusp of an election that would decide the balance of power in the state, the white Democrats of Wilmington sought to seize control through the threat of violence, propaganda, and outright tampering, leading to a landslide win for their candidates. But victory at the polls wasn't enough for the most powerful in Wilmington. They wanted to put an end to any hope the black community may have in forging their own equal standing in society, and they did so by taking to the streets with guns and threats, both of which they discharged with impunity. On the morning of November 10, 1898, Wilmington was a city on edge. But its residents would soon come to realize that by the end of the day, it would also be a city changed forever. This is Cape Fear Unearthed, the podcast exploring the persisting legends, historical oddities, and landmark stories of southeastern North Carolina. As always, I'm your host, Hunter Ingram, and I'm a reporter with the Star News here in Wilmington. This week on the show, we're launching our biggest project yet, with a 3-episode series detailing arguably the most important story that we will ever tell on this show, the 1898 Wilmington Massacre. This is by far the most requested story from our listeners. But this is not a simple story to tell. To understand why Wilmington devolved from a city of burgeoning racial opportunity into a festering wound of white supremacy, it requires an understanding of what events set in motion the violence of November 10, 1898, what unfolded on that day, and perhaps most importantly, how the scars left in its wake irrevocably changed the city. So that's how we're going to tackle this topic. In this first episode, we will cover Wilmington from the end of the Civil War through the election of 1898, exploring how the city became a majority black community, how a political shift in power terrified white Democrats desperate to hold on to control, and how they sought to steal that power back through duplicitous and downright murderous means. Then, in our second episode, we'll pick up with the events of November 10, 1898, as the campaign of white supremacy turned into an all-out mob, walking the streets of Wilmington, issuing ultimatums from behind the barrels of guns. In our third and final episode, we will tell of the aftermath, both in the days and weeks after the coup, and the long-term impacts these events have had on our city. This is not an easy story to tell, nor is it going to be an easy story for you to digest. But to help us do our best at both, I have gathered 7 renowned guests who have studied this history and worked to preserve its legacy so it is never forgotten. We won't have scripted portions in this series, but rather these episodes will be my conversations with our guests, where all of our voices help tell the story of 1898. And because of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic and the remote location of our guests, we recorded these interviews over video conferencing, so please bear with us on the audio quality. I've wrestled with when to do this story since I started Cape Fear Unearthed more than 2 years ago. But I think that 2020 has proven the time is now. So sit back, settle in, and join me for the first episode of Unearthing 1898. Joining me now to start our discussion of 1898 are 3 very special guests, 2 of which you will recognize if you've been with us on the show for a while now. Those 2 guests are Jan Davidson, the historian for the Cape Fear Museum here in Wilmington, and Chris E. Fonville Jr., a local historian and an author. Jan and Chris, thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Oh, it's always great to be here. Thank you, Hunter.
Thank you for having me, Hunter.
Absolutely. And joining us for the first time is Leray Umfleet. Now, Leray is going to be with us for all 3 episodes of Unearthing 1898. And the reason I brought her on is because she was the lead researcher on the state's commission on 1898, which sought to better understand the events that we're going to discuss in this series. And over the course of several years, she and her team put together a 500-page report that was published in 2006, and then she turned it into her own book called A Day of Blood. So, Leray, welcome to Cape Fear Unearthed.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
And I'm thrilled to have you be a consistent voice with us as we kind of move through this and bring in different voices who can give some different perspectives on the many topics that we're going to be discussing within this series. So I want to start off with Chris, because Chris, you have come on this show and we have talked about Wilmington's contributions to the Civil War through Forts Fisher and Fort Anderson and so many other ways. But after Wilmington falls in February 1865, and the war comes to an end a few months later in April, what did Wilmington look like in those next few years? I mean, it's still the state's largest city, but how had the war changed Wilmington politically, racially?
Well, the Las Vegas of the South, as I have often referred to Wilmington, fell hard on hard times within about 4 months. Wilmington, as you know, was the most active, busiest, prosperous, thriving if bawdy and boisterous seaport in the Confederacy by 1863, and the Confederacy's most important city by late 1864. And the fall of Fort Fisher and auxiliary works in the winter of 1865, and the capture of Wilmington in February of that year, meant a complete transition for the city and its people. Much of the city was greatly damaged by Confederate forces during its evacuation on February the 21st. Much of the downtown area was burned. Many white residents had left the city just prior to the Union Army's arrival. The Union Army, of course, included among its roughly 14,500 troops, two brigades of United States colored troops. So the arrival of African Americans in the ranks of the Union Army was a great thrill and a moment of liberation for Wilmington's African American population, most of whom remained in Wilmington after the Confederates and residents had largely abandoned the city. So Union forces took over in late February. They instilled martial law, military rule, at least until the end of June of 1865. Economy, commerce was at a standstill until residents took an oath of allegiance to the Union. There was a great deal of resentment among those white residents who remained behind in Wilmington, particularly at the appearance of United States colored troops, which became part of the occupation forces, at least until 1866. So there was quite a bit of racial tension. There was a great need for laborers. So African-Americans had opportunities for that, as did white refugees. And in fact, as a result of the Civil War, Wilmington actually became a black majority. Now, officially did not become a black majority until the census records of 1870 were released, by which time the black population was 58% of the total population. But because of the influx of African-American refugees right at the end of the war into Wilmington, somewhere between 6,000 and 8,000, perhaps as many as 10,000. We're not quite sure of the figures. Wilmington became a black majority and would remain a black majority until 1898.
So, LeRae, this sets up this process of American history known as Reconstruction. Now, if anyone needs a refresher course of this, this is the period in American history where the Southern states that seceded from the Union were brought back under the Union after the Civil War. And more importantly, this was the time when millions of former slaves were being integrated into society as freed citizens. And so I'm curious, how does this process and how does this very important era of the post-war America play out here in Wilmington and across North Carolina?
So Reconstruction was this long period of a political, economic, and social struggle to integrate the new United States after the Civil War and figure out where these former enslaved people fit into the grand scheme of things. The 13th Amendment was passed in 1865, which freed all enslaved peoples. And then 1866, it's followed by the 14th Amendment, which gives citizenship to these newly freed enslaved peoples. And then not until we get into 1869 do we have the 15th Amendment that guarantees these folks the right to vote. Because up until 1877, which is technically the end of Reconstruction, you see white politicians working to minimize the access to everything the Constitution and the Declaration promise, which is the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for Black Americans. So Black codes became a thing, and all of the work that had been done to guarantee rights to African Americans were done away with in individual states, including North Carolina, through these Black codes, which limited their ability to vote, ability to buy property, to education, and these things. So throughout the whole period of Reconstruction, there was a struggle between giving access to full citizenship and then taking it away between whites and blacks. In Wilmington, the African Americans who had been in the city prior to the Civil War, many of them were free blacks. They found ways to organize themselves and combat the efforts to minimize their participation in government through freedmen's bureaus and the union leagues. They unionized themselves. They would even organize themselves to counter KKK rallies in the city. And the KKK comes to North Carolina for the first time during Reconstruction, and they were a tool of the Democratic Party. And this is where we have to point out that Democrats and Republicans of the 19th century are not Democrats and Republicans of 2020, that their philosophies are almost exactly the opposite of what they are today. Not completely, but almost. And so Democrats are traditionally in the 19th century men who were former Confederates. Lots of times they were farmers, and they were conservative in their approach to life and economics and those sorts of things. The Republican Party was the party of Abraham Lincoln, the party that freed the slaves, the party of progressive, business-minded white men. And so most African Americans voted for the Republican Party, as did businessmen who came to North Carolina after the Civil War to find a new South. And so there's a struggle between these two political parties, and the KKK becomes an arm of the Democratic Party. Reconstruction's goal ultimately was to find a way for African Americans to get integrated into the economy and into cultural and civic life in the United States. By the end of Reconstruction, North Carolina had become more industrial, and African Americans were becoming entrepreneurs and owning their own businesses and earning wages along the same lines as white workers. And I would argue, however, that I didn't see that Reconstruction ended until 1898, because Reconstruction's goal was to pull African Americans into the United States and give them opportunities, political voice. And that was evident for African Americans up until 1898. We had men serving in the legislature in Raleigh, in the Congress in Washington, D.C. from North Carolina, and we had the Board of Aldermen in Wilmington with African American politicians.
And what you saw, Hunter, was the rise of a middle class in the African American community in Wilmington. Guys like Robert Taylor, who was the first African American graduate of MIT, and the entrepreneurship of African Americans, as Larray said, on many levels, from restaurant owners to real estate offices and attorneys. But African American aldermen were elected to the city government as early as 1868. So it wasn't many years after the war ended that they were really finding their way forward in our community. And it was a delicate dance between blacks and whites, obviously, because whites clearly resented the rise of this black middle class and the progress that African Americans were making in Wilmington, the vast influx of African Americans into the community. But at the same time, they needed them as laborers as they tried to revive the naval stores industry and the rice industries, and they needed them to rebuild the community and build a greatly expanding community and the railroads that helped with the expansion of business in Wilmington, the coming of the cotton trade by 1876 with Alexander Sprunt and Sons. They needed African Americans, but at the same time, they resented the progress that African Americans were making on so many levels.
Well, and Jan, in the research that you've done, because I know the Cape Fear Museum just recently published a interactive map of sorts that charts this whole story of 1898. And so I'm curious, do we know what was driving this prosperity for the black community in Wilmington where it wasn't in other southern communities? Why was Wilmington special in a way?
I mean, I think that we do. And I think we do know that in part because of Larray's work, but also the work of other scholars. And one of the things that's really important for us to understand in this era is that New Hanover County was a place with a long-standing black majority. Looking at the census, the data that we have from 1790 on, if you include three people of color in the antebellum period, we have a black majority throughout the century and to 1900. And So that means that when our political system changes and African-American men get the right to vote and they start voting in our region, first for delegates to the North Carolina Constitutional Convention in 1867 and then in 1868 and on through the era, we have a place where Black men's political power can help the rest of civic society and economic society. So that's really an important piece. As long as Black men could vote and there were offices for them to vote for, and as long as there was a Black majority in the county, there likely would be a multiracial government in New Hanover County. There were also, because we were a place of both urban and rural enslavement, enslaved people before the end of the Civil War had amazing skills. There were craftsmen here, folks who built the Bellamy House and all kinds of other places around town. There were coopers, there were blacksmiths, and women who used the skills that they were, you know, learned during the slaves' times that then translated those skills into economic opportunities after the war. And so there's this core group of folks who go on to be very entrepreneurial and business-minded, as well as after the war, and especially by the 1890s, you have a generation emancipated peoples who have taken the opportunities, men, women, children, understood the power of an education and the importance of learning how to read and write and what those skills gave to you as a citizen, as a person. And so by the 1890s, we have this 30 years of people striving and taking opportunities where they land and being supported by having political power within their community.
But the point I wanted to make here is that the resistance to this prosperity and the opportunity for Black residents is springing up simultaneously with the effort to build it up, to provide these opportunities. So that really leads to some systematic changes and efforts to stifle that early on. And one of them even was the formation of a local county here.
Yes. So I think it's really important for us not to say in 1897, Wilmington and New Hanover County were this wonderful bastion of racial equality, and that 1898 is this moment where everything just goes to hell in a handbasket and it's a dramatic change. Yes, it's a dramatic assertion of white power, but there's always been this tension since emancipation about how do we deal with our society and who gets the power and who gets the rights to vote. And in 1868, the state took this dramatic step towards expanding democracy. You didn't have to own property to be an officer or to hold elected office. You had to believe in God, but it didn't necessarily need to be a Christian God in order to stand. This was an expansion of democracy. And we see that in history. There are these moments where, usually with the support of the African-American community, democracy expands for all. And then there are these moments where there are appeals to race and the idea of race trumping humanity, and you end up taking steps backwards. So we see expansions and contractions in people's access to power and access to the vote even before 1898. And so, yes, in the 1870s, Pender County is chopped off New Hanover County and formed as a new county named after a Confederate general, I believe, and created by the White Democratic Party. And the idea is that over time, even though it was a Black majority, that taking Pender County and separating it from New Hanover County would diminish the power of the city of Wilmington and the Black county of New Hanover County. So in the 1870s, these guys are looking forward. They're looking at the long game of how they're going to assert white supremacy onto the landscape.
Now, one thing that we do need to explain, which I'm not someone who has a political mind, but we have Republicans, we have Democrats. As Larae mentioned, they kind of operated on opposite ends of the political spectrum than what we know of today. But there was also this disillusionment, this unrest with some of the people who were in the Democratic Party, and they didn't feel that the Democratic Party was serving their interests as well as it was some of the other white members. And so they form a different party that forms another party. And so who wants to tell us about the origin of the Fusionist Party? Because that becomes a real big player in the 1894 election.
Okay.
This is your bailiwick, Lorraine.
Yeah.
So fusion is one of those political topics that when you teach it in the classroom, your students start to have their eyes roll back in their head because it's all about who's giving this and who's conceding that and what the political players want to do and how they want to do it. So for your listeners, I'm going to distill it into just a few sentences. And if they really want to read more about it, there's some really good books about fusion. Ballots and Fence Rails is a good book that puts everything in perspective for the Wilmington region. So in the early 1890s, there was a group of Democratic voters, mostly farmers, who felt like the Democratic Party wasn't addressing their needs when it came to agricultural things, to economic concerns. And so they pulled themselves away from the Democratic Party. And what it eventually became was the Populist Party. And the Populist Party was led by Senator Marion Butler. And the Populist Party was a small minority in the greater scheme of things about how many Democrats there are, how many Republicans there are, and how many populists there are. And essentially, populists and Republicans were the minority voters in the whole scheme of tallying up the votes for who was voting for who. And so the Republicans and the populists realized that the only way that they were going to get their platforms accomplished was to merge or fuse their votes together. And so this is called fusion. Fusion resulted in the election of populists and Republicans to the legislature in 1894 and of Governor Russell in 1896. Governor Russell was technically a Republican, but he ran on the fusion ticket, which was to address the concerns and needs of both of those individual parties. Fusion was tenuous. Not everyone got everything they wanted. The populists sometimes didn't feel like they were getting their due in laws being passed. But the overall result of fusion meant that we had our first Republican governor is sitting in Raleigh since Reconstruction. And the laws that were being passed in the legislature in Raleigh were those that were more egalitarian, that gave the average Joe more voice in government and more freedom to do what they felt was best in their areas. Raleigh quit its control of city government and county government and let the counties and cities take care of their business more so than before. And so fusion was tenuous, as I said, and by 1896, with the governor being elected, the hope was that they would have another fusion governor elected in 1900, and there was an 1898 midterm election. Then that midterm election became the pivot point for the Democratic Party to figure out a way to break apart fusion.
Well, and one thing that we need to underscore here is that in 1894, the Fusionist Party wiped the floor with the Democrats. They are able to get almost every single one of their candidates into a position. And this results in Black men taking the positions that were once held by white men. And so the Democrats were, you know, really humiliated in that particular election because they saw this progress that they were already not very happy with really come in and just like blatantly stifle their influence and their reach into the government. And so it's only ratcheting up the tension, correct, as we get through the 1890s.
The white supremacy platform for the Democratic Party had been part of their toolkit ever since the end of the Civil War, but it was only successful for the very first time in 1898. And it's because of these many factors you point to that white men had a perceived loss of power and authority and control over all forms of government, whether it be local, state, or national. And they were seeing that also affect their economic life and their civic life. And they needed to find a way to get that power back. And 1898 is the beginning of that return to power for the white supremacy platform.
So starting in 1894, after their immense losses in that election, what do the Democrats of North Carolina and the Democrats who were on the ground here in Wilmington do to start reasserting their control, or at least kind of steal it back? And Luray, I know that you have a way that you explain this to people when you're talking to them about 1898. And so I want to kind of hear your thoughts on the methods that were taken at this point in history.
So I got this from the News and Observer's editor, Josephus Daniels. And Daniels wrote in his autobiography that he was an unapologetic Democratic Party supporter, and he would do and say anything to support the Democratic Party. And Daniels pointed out that the Democratic Party, under the leadership of Furnifold Simmons, who was the state overall Democratic Party chairperson, that they would use men who could speak, men who could write, and men who could ride. And so the men who could write were the newspaper people like Daniels and the editors of the Wilmington newspapers who were pro-democratic. And they published articles and cartoons and ads and other things that all worked to create a narrative of why white men needed to vote for the Democratic Party, that they needed to protect white women, that they, you know, a black man, regardless of whether they had white skin or black skin, it was a black man who voted for the Republican Party. And these newspapers were the first arm of the three-prong attack that was developed to undermine fusion, which was the ultimate goal. They needed to pull those white voters away from the Populist Party, away from the Republican Party, and these were the ways they were going to do that. So first was the newspapers. And secondly, there were the men who could speak. And these were people who traveled around the state giving speeches in support of the Democratic Party. And there were rallies. These were big to-dos. You have to remember, in 1898, we didn't have Twitter. We didn't have CNN. And so we didn't really have an opportunity to hear the voices of the politicians until they came to your town. And it was a big deal. They'd get off the train, they'd have a big speechifying, they would potentially host a barbecue event, and then there would be more speeches. And these were fiery speeches that inflamed the voters and made these white men second guess their support of the populist ticket, and made them think that if they wanted to be good patriotic Americans in support of white women and the future of their children, they needed to vote for the Democratic Party, which was the white supremacy platform.
Or they would use harder line tactics. They would intimidate them, threaten them, their businesses. Either you vote Democrat or we boycott your businesses.
They did. They did. And that's the third prong, which is the red shirts. And the red shirts are the 1898 redo of what the KKK was doing earlier. And so the red shirts were men who wore red shirts that were made at home by their families. And they rode on horseback many times through African-American and white communities that were Republican to intimidate the voters and keep them away, and to remind them that their homes, their businesses, and their families were in physical jeopardy. And they would beat people up. They would break windows. They would damage stores and stock and equipment. And it was a terrifying thing to know that the red shirts had you in their sights. And so usually when there was a speech being given with a fiery speech maker like Alfred Moore Waddell of Wilmington, there would then be a red shirt rally immediately afterwards to reinforce the points that were given in the more civilized speech. And then you'd have the less civilized chaos of the red shirts riding through African-American neighborhoods firing guns.
Well, let's talk a minute for our listeners and identify who Alfred Moore Waddell was, because he becomes a very important player in this, especially on the day of 1898. So who was Alfred Moore Waddell, and kind of what is his role in the lead up to 1898?
I'll start it. I mean, he was from Hillsborough, North Carolina, third great grandson of General Hugh Waddell, who was a colonial military officer. He was a Confederate officer in the 3rd North Carolina Cavalry during the war, resigned in 1864, and lived for the rest of his life in Wilmington, was a fiery orator, a firebrand. He actually was against secession. He was a publisher and editor of the Wilmington-based Herald newspaper that advocated for union. But, you know, like most unionists, pre-war unionists, he changed his tune after the war began and became a U.S. congressman after the war, was defeated in a re-election in 1878, ironically, by Daniel Russell, which is an interesting aside because, of course, Alfred Moore Waddell would be the ringleader of the riot of 1898 when Daniel Russell was governor. So I have to think that there was a personal vendetta involved in this. So that's just sort of who he was. And Lorraine and Jan can take it from there.
Yeah. So Alfred Moore Waddell, by the 1890s, he is an older man. He was born in the 1830s. He is definitely white supremacist, but he's also in this, in some senses, for his own opportunity. And so he begins to give speeches, and he is probably the most known local speech maker of this white supremacy campaign, which, as Lorraine told us, was so planned and thought out. And what he does is he is a really good at inflaming racial tensions. And he says a number of things, from if we need to shoot people to keep them away, shoot African-Americans to keep them away from the polls, we will. And if we need to choke the river with African-American carcasses, we also will. He is willing to give speeches that, you know, provoke and promote violence against the Black community and our Black community in order to reassert this white power over the landscape.
Right. And Waddell, because he was so good at that speech making, it's been remarked that Wilmington's cause became the cause of all in 1898 because Waddell was so good at explaining from his perspective the dangers of Black assertiveness in the civic world, the economic world, and the political world. And so his role is very clear in the programs of 1898. He's traveling all over the place speaking about Wilmington. And in addition to choking the Cape Fear River with the carcasses of dead Black bodies, Waddell also said the day before the election, "Go to the polls tomorrow. If you see a Negro out voting, shoot him, kill him in his tracks. We shall win tomorrow if we have to do it with guns." So you can't get much more clear about what Waddell thought about African-American voting and how they were going to win the election.
I want to jump back before we advance into the setup, the real setup of the 1898 election, and just mention something that Lorraine touched on earlier about these men who could write. In 1898, people were getting their news from a newspaper. And so that piece of this campaign for the white supremacists is so important because they were not only writing about these speeches, they were putting in political cartoons and propaganda because you couldn't always count on your readership to be literate and to be able to discern and wade through political speech. And so these political cartoons played a very important role to stoke fear among the white citizenry of North Carolina and Wilmington that giving power to Black residents was dangerous. Now, I work for a newspaper that was involved in this. You know, the Wilmington Morning Star was a mouthpiece in a way, just like the News and Observer was in Raleigh for the white supremacist cause. I want to firmly tell you that is not what the Star News is today. We are absolutely not affiliated with any of these opinions of the men and women who worked at the Wilmington Morning Star in 1898. They were serving as a mouthpiece for a particular segment of the community. Today, we serve every segment of the community. And so they employ these political cartoons in a way to make sure everyone gets the message. And one of these that is in Lorraine's book, it includes what is essentially a winged vampire that is a Black man. On his wings, it is written Negro rule, and his clawed hands are outstretched trying to get white women. And at the bottom of the cartoon, it reads, "The vampire that hovers over North Carolina." So, Lorraine, why was this propaganda so vitally important to the white supremacist cause?
So the Democratic Party saw that it needed to do everything possible to bring Democratic voters who had potentially voted for the fusion ticket in 1894 or 1896 back to the fold and have them vote for the Democratic candidates. And these newspaper articles, the ads, the cartoons were the most important piece for many people like Josephus Daniels and the Wilmington newspapers to do that work. And they sought to publish any story that would demonstrate that Black men were taking too many liberties, that they were threatening white women, that they were corrupt. And in fact, Josephus Daniels even wrote in his autobiography that if he published a story and found out later that it wasn't true, he wouldn't retract it because it was his goal to sell papers and to promote the Democratic Party. And so that's the main thrust of the propaganda campaign from 1898. And I'd like to point out that even the newspapers were printing handbills that were being distributed. And there was one that was pointing out, "Remember the Six." And that was identifying six businessmen in Wilmington who were part of the Republican Party leadership in Wilmington. And I just want to read from that handbill. "These degenerate sons of the white race who control the Republican machine in this county, or those whose position made them influential in putting Negro rule on the whites, will suffer the penalty of their responsibility for any disturbance consequence on the determination of the white men of this county to carry the election at any cost." And as they whittled down, it was "Remember the Six, Remember the Five, Remember the Four." So they were forcing these Republican men into submission.
It shows just how coordinated this was, how planned this was, and how much they were relying on things that we think of today as really important means of information. They were using them for very malicious purposes. And I want to make sure that we note that it wasn't just the men who were doing this. In newspapers, there were also editorials from women who were also making the case. And there is a specific one by a woman named Rebecca Felton, and she was from Georgia, and she publishes this editorial about the dangers that Black men pose to white women. And again, I think reading directly from these words is really important, because paraphrasing sometimes just doesn't really do the disturbing nature of them justice. And so I'm going to read you just a sentence from the editorial that she wrote that ran in August of 1898. And it reads, "When there is not enough religion in the pulpit to organize a crusade against sin, nor justice in the courthouse to promptly punish crime, nor manhood enough in the nation to put a sheltering arm about innocence and virtue, if it needs lynching to protect woman's dearest possession from the ravening human beast, then I say lynch 1,000 times a week if necessary." Those were words that stoked immense fear. And so this was used as a rallying cry for white residents, because it was republished all over the South. It was republished here in Wilmington in August 1898 at the Wilmington Morning Star. And that is a real tipping point for the story we're telling, because we're going to move directly into the events of the fall of 1898, because there's a gentleman who responds directly to this. His name is Alexander Manley. He is the editor of the Daily Record here in Wilmington. It was over on 9th Street. He runs this newspaper that is a Black-run newspaper. It is informing the Black community. It is a vitally important piece of the Black community, because it is a way for them to communicate with each other and share what is important to that community in Wilmington, where clearly these other newspapers and other sources were not. And he writes a responsive editorial to her. And so, Lorraine, what was his point that he was trying to make, and why did it inflame people so much?
Manley was African-American. He was well-educated, and he ran just like we have pro-Democratic Party newspapers, he ran a pro-Republican newspaper. And his newspaper, prior to this hot season of election in 1898, received both white and black readership, and advertisements were from both white and black members of the business community. But he took opportunities to promote the Republican Party and African-American interests in things. And he was the voice of the black community, sharing across the entire city information for black voters. And when Rebecca Latimer Felton's article was published in the paper in 1898, it was already a year old, but it was useful for the campaign, so they ran it. And the fact that it was a year old was minimized, because it really ran home to, if white women need to be protected, white men need to do everything possible to protect those white women. Because essentially, she said, all black men want to do is rape white women all day long, every day. And so Manly was actually a mulatto. He was mixed, and his mother or grandmother, depending on which account you look at, was potentially raped by her white owner, and he was the result of a mixed race relationship, and one that was probably not consensual. So he took the effort to point out that although white men have been taking liberties with black women over the years, conversely, white women have chosen to be with black men. And that was an affront to white manhood when these white leaders read this. And they couldn't sit and let that slide. And it became a rallying point for the Democratic Party to take this editorial out of context. They ran it daily in the newspapers as a horrid slander by a black brute against white manhood and against white womanhood. And Manly became a target of the Democratic Party campaign following this editorial.
So we talked about Rebecca Felton's words, and we've heard from Alfred Moore Waddell, and we also have the words of Alexandra Manly in that editorial that provide us with another resource to understanding these events. And I think the most powerful piece that he says that caused so much consternation at the time is, every Negro lynched is called a big, burly, black brute, when in fact many of those have been who have been dealt with had white men for their fathers and were not only not black and burly, but were sufficiently attractive for white girls of culture and refinement to fall in love with them, as is well known to all. So he's in direct opposition to Rebecca Felton and so many of the white supremacists who are promoting this idea of white women's purity and black men's assault on those purity, and saying, no, there are consensual relationships. And in an era when mixed race marriages are illegal, saying that white women fell in love with black men is incredibly incendiary, and is in some ways really challenging to understand why he would have said that at this moment. And yet he clearly felt compelled to do so.
That is why they latched on to this editorial from him, and again, ran it repeatedly in the papers in the days afterwards under the same headline, a horrid slander. This was slanderous to say. It did not acknowledge the fact that everything she was saying was not only inaccurate, but racist and vile. But what he was saying was in direct opposition of what the white mindset of that time would have been. And so they would have absolutely latched on to his very words and would keep sharing them throughout that fall, making sure that no one forgot what he had written.
I think most of us, most historians would agree, if it hadn't been this, it would have been something else. You know, that they would have found the Democratic Party, as Lorraine has been saying, used every tool that they could get a hold of. And this was a thing that could they could fan the flames with. But the white supremacists had already set the fire.
What happens to Alexander Manley and the Daily Record is something we're going to touch on in our second episode, because it all unfolds on the day of November 10th, 1898. But copies of the Daily Record are very rare. But Jan, you at the museum, or the museum, have a few copies of his paper that you use as educational tools for classes and for museum visitors, correct?
Yes, we do. We actually have three copies from 1898, two from August after the editorial is published. We don't have the one where that editorial is published. And then a third one is from October 20th, 1898. And as Lorraine has already said, and you've alluded to, Hunter, they're an amazing resource because they do give you the words of or the opinions and viewpoints through the lens of an African-American man, an African-American member of the community, rather than the words of white people explaining African-Americans. And like Lorray said, there are black and whites who advertised in there. You get that there's an ice cream store you can go to, but you also get the viewpoints of Alexander Manley. And the paper is a big advocate for voting. So in the October 20th edition, it says, remember to register, because the deadline for registering to vote was coming up, and Manley wanted to be sure that African-American men could vote in that election. And there's also editorials that give you a sense of his point of view about the events of the time, including an acknowledgement in an article called What Is There to Fear, that there is heightened racial tension in the community. He talks about red shirts and guns, but really hopes that the common cause that poor whites and poor blacks, that fusion will hold, and also hopes that more well-to-do white population will recognize that violence in Wilmington would not be good for business. So even though he's acknowledging that there is has been this rise in racial tension, he clearly knows that the white paper has been publishing this article, basically calling him a slanderer for weeks. It's out there, but he's still hopeful that things will be okay in Wilmington. And that may be in part because there is still a black majority in the city, and that, you know, as an educated African-American man, he is living proof, and his newspaper is living proof, that African-Americans are entrepreneurial and, you know, well-educated citizens. His paper couldn't exist without emancipation and the gains in the black community that we'd seen in the 35 years since that time.
Now, for our listeners, they will recognize that Chris Fonville had to jump off of the call, but I want to thank him for joining us. As we approach what we know of as 1898, I want to identify just a few key players before we move forward. If you live in our area, you have heard the name Hugh McCrae. And that's most recently because his name was stripped off of a county-run park that was named for him. And it has become such a lightning rod of controversy over the years, especially now in 2020, when the county chose to take action based on his record, specifically his record during this year of 1898 and his role in the white supremacist movement. So who was Hugh McCrae, and who were the Secret Nine, which is what he was a part of, that helped drive this movement to its end result, which was the violence of November 10th?
Hugh McCrae was a businessman at his very basic level. He was president of the Wilmington Cotton Mills Company. He later became head of what would become Carolina Power and Light. And he was a developer, an entrepreneur, and exceptionally wealthy. He and other men like him who were at the top of the economic spectrum in Wilmington were members of the Secret Nine, the Group Six, all of these different things. And their ultimate goal was to be leadership for the Democratic Party and the campaign in Wilmington. And it was, in a nutshell, not only a social thing to promote the white supremacy campaign, but also because they were members of the Democratic Party and they had not been in leadership in the city for quite a while, these businessmen wanted control of the city's finances, the city's projects. So, for example, if you were a businessman and you needed improvements to the wharf or a channel dredged or a new fire station built in your community, if your business wasn't represented in the Board of Aldermen by a Democratic member familiar with your needs, your particular interests may not be served when the more fusionist Republican-leaning Board of Aldermen were doing all they could to be egalitarian and helping build roads in areas that had not been paved and helping everyone across the city, regardless of race and status, improve their infrastructure. So McCray and other men like him were doing what they felt they needed to do, not only for the basis of the Democratic Party, but also for their economic interests. And these men were part of the overall plan to take control of the city, the county, and the state on behalf of the Democratic Party in a phased approach beginning in 1898 and moving into 1900.
And I will say that another member of the Secret Nine was Walter Parsley. And Walter Parsley's name was also stripped off of the elementary school here in Wilmington that was named after him this year. And so you see, even 122 years later, the community here still grappling with the events of 1898, both those events that led up to it and everything that happened because of it. And so 1898 is still very much a conversation that is happening in Wilmington every day. And that is why it's so important for us to talk about.
Can I just say, though, that part of the reason that the Hugh McCray Park has had such resonance is not simply 1898, it's that that land was given to the county for white citizens only. And so that is the segregation in Wilmington and in New Hanover County in North Carolina is in part fueled by the events of 1898. And his role is definitely a reason, but there are whole generations of African Americans who have not gone to that park because of both the legacy of 1898 and the blatant discrimination that was embedded in that park's being gifted to the county.
And that's a great point to make because it is much broader than just a single person. I think, again, this is a systematic movement that is bigger than one person. His name gets a lot of attention because it was on the park. But you're correct. I mean, you see efforts to suppress the Black community, not just at the ballot box, not just in economic opportunities, but just where they can go and visit a park. I mean, it is about keeping these people out of your society in a very, very blatant and widespread way. So the election happens on November 8th, 1898. And I want to know how that goes down because we've been talking about all these ways that the white supremacist movement suppressed the vote, intimidated Black residents. So how did it all unfold on Election Day, Larae? Did we see Black residents go out to the ballot box? Did they take that risk?
So even before the election, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party realized the tensions had gotten so tight in Wilmington that the Republican Party made concessions and removed some politicians from the ballot so that it would be a point of compromise with the Democratic Party to alleviate some of the pressure. However, come the morning of Election Day, November 8th, the city was tense and everyone was ready to do their duty to vote. Workers in the city had been given the day off so that they could go vote. The red shirts were up at it bright and early. There were wagons that were taken from various businesses around town that the red shirts used to go collect voters and escort them to their polling place. And voting then is different than voting today. Then it was much more public. People could see how you were voting. They could stand and look over your shoulder and make sure you voted the right way. And if you didn't vote the right way, there were going to be consequences. So they'd pick you up from wherever you lived, take you to your polling place, watch you, make sure you voted, and then take you back home. That was done across the city for Democratic voters. For African-American voters, they went to the polls. They did their best to do their duty as citizens to vote. However, it was not easy because these same red shirts were at each polling place outside harassing voters, making sure that they knew that they were being watched. In fact, prior to the election, the process of even registering to vote was one that was fraught with danger because African-American workers were told, if you register to vote, you will lose your job. And then even after they took the opportunity to register, if they were then seen voting, their jobs were in jeopardy as well. So it took some fortitude to vote for your candidate if you were African-American or Republican in 1898. And so these Republican men did their duty. And then at the end of the day, the poll workers were responsible for counting the votes at each precinct. And there were African-American poll workers in African-American precincts who were supposed to do their jobs. But they were also harassed because there were poll watchers with red shirts on. And the men in one predominantly African-American precinct reported that they were harassed while trying to count the votes, that red shirts stormed the voting facility and extinguished the lights. And when the lights were back on after a scuffle, there were more votes cast in the ballot box for the Democratic candidates than there were people registered to vote in the African-American majority Republican district. So we know that there was voter fraud. We know that ballot boxes were stuffed. We know that there was voter intimidation. And yet it was still taken as a responsibility by African-Americans to go vote. And at the end of the day, when all the votes were counted, Democratic candidates won every post that they had a candidate up for. It was a complete and thorough victory for the Democratic Party.
And you really have to acknowledge the bravery and the risk it took for African Americans in this town to even try to go vote, knowing that their vote probably would not count in the way that it should, knowing that they were going to be intimidated, knowing that not voting right could get them beaten up outside, could get their homes trashed, all these things. They still wanted to go and exercise this very American right. And so the fortitude it took to just go to the polls that day.
We also have to remember that there were a good number of white Republican voters as well, and they faced that same level of intimidation and violence. And if they were white business owners, many of them faced economic ruin during this time period as well.
So as LeRae just mentioned, it was a sweeping victory for the Democrats, one that they didn't really earn, but one that they made sure they stole. And on November 9th, the day after the election, they are celebrating. But this is still isn't enough for them. They want to make sure that they're not put in this position again, where they have to fend off what they see as an inferior race from maybe making a play for the power that they so definitively covet. And so they meet in the morning on November 9th, and there's hundreds of white men who are invited to this meeting where they are going to talk about further steps. What are these further steps to make sure that this power they've just gained does not somehow revert back to the Republicans and the populace?
So one point we have to remember about the election of 1898 is that it wasn't an election to seat a new mayor or board of aldermen for the city of Wilmington. That election wouldn't take place until 1899. So the fusionist mayor and board of aldermen would still be sitting in governing the city of Wilmington for another year. And the Democratic Party had done so much work to put their candidates in office at the state and national level that they didn't want to wait to have anything else happen. So on the morning of November 9th, there's a meeting of white men, and Alfred Moore Wydell, our great speechmaker, takes control of the helm. This is something that those folks in the Secret Nine and the Group of Six and all of these other Democratic Party strategists had come together with. And they called it a meeting of the white men to come up with the White Declaration of Independence. And so the White Declaration of Independence was developed that day. Of course, they had already rewritten it and prepared for it. But they decided that white men of... I don't have it memorized.
Hold on. There, I'll say it. So in the preamble of the White Declaration of Independence, they have a line that reads, "We, the undersigned citizens of the city of Wilmington and the county of New Hanover, do hereby declare that we will no longer be ruled and will never again be ruled by men of African origin."
Right. And so that's their preamble. And they then set up a series of demands to take over control of the city of Wilmington, that Alex Manley needs to stop printing his paper, that he needs to leave the city, that the mayor and board of aldermen need to resign. And they take these demands and codify them. And Alfred Moore Wydell is made chair of a committee of 25 leading white citizens to present these demands to the Black community. And so they call together a group of African-American leaders, churchmen, businessmen, civic leaders, and they give them these demands. And they call this group of men the Committee of Colored Citizens. And they expect a response from the Committee of Colored Citizens almost immediately. And these men say, well, in the interest of peace, we want to do all that we can to find ways to meet the demands of the white community. And so they go back and they try to formulate a reply. And their response was that we, the colored citizens to whom was referred the matter of expulsion from this community of the person in press of Alex Manley, do beg most respectfully to say that we are in no way responsible nor in any way condone his obnoxious article. But in the interest of peace, we will most willingly use our influence to have your wishes carried out. So they realized that they couldn't make anything happen, but they could certainly try to find a safer path to navigate through the tensions that had been built up over the course of the election season. And Wydell expects delivery of these answers the next morning on November 10th. And we'll talk more about the activity of November 10th in your next episode, but the reply doesn't get to Wydell in time.
And I want to also mention that in the White Declaration of Independence, it is not about just those immediate resignations. It's not about banishing Alexander Manley and dismantling his printing press. It is also about these statements of wanting to potentially take away the enfranchisement of Black voters in town. They also want to start giving jobs that could go to Black residents. They want to start giving those to white residents. And so it's about setting those immediate pieces, but also really kind of giving insight into what they saw as the society they wanted, where white people were getting every opportunity they could, and Black people were left to maybe get some if they could. The White Declaration of Independence, just by its name, is insane. But it really does kind of show the plan that these men had for Wilmington and the plan that they were going to start enacting immediately. And that's terrifying.
Yeah, and they knew that they needed to take economic power from African Americans as well as political power. We spent a lot of time talking about the politics today, and I think that's because it is so, so important. But it also, that declaration talks about making sure that white men get jobs instead of Black men. And there are some ways that, I mean, the the city doesn't control as many jobs as it does today, and the county doesn't control as many jobs as it does today. Government was on a different scale, but there are definitely places where, you know, there were African-American firefighters, there were African-American police officers, there were African-American coroner who was actually elected. There were lots of ways that African-Americans gained jobs through political power that, you know, those things are targeted in that declaration as well. So it's not simply just the politics, it's the politics, it's the economics, it's the targeting, that, as Larae talked about, the church leaders and other leaders, is the social elite is being put on the spot as well. This is a holistic campaign to target the strengths of the African-American community.
You're correct. I mean, they're trying to get at the heart of what is the livelihood of the Black community in Wilmington. And they have the manpower to do it. And they start executing that plan the next day on November 10th, which is what we're going to detail in our second episode. And so what is it like here in this city as the sun goes down, knowing that what essentially is a threat has been issued and they want a response by 7:30 the next morning? I mean, I have to imagine this city is tense.
Yes, the city was exceptionally on edge. The white community was divided into blocks. There were men who were called block captains for each block. Those men knew how many white men, children, women, elderly lived on their block. They knew how many guns were at the ready in those houses on their block. They had 24-hour patrols around those blocks, and they would stop African-Americans who were going through white communities to rough them up a little bit, to ask them, what are you doing? Why are you here? And many times these were domestic workers who were going to work in the white houses on those blocks. And it was a thoroughly intimidating thing for a white, for a Black person to walk through a white community. And these patrols had been taking place for many, many days prior to the election and continued the night of the election into the next day, because not only were the patrols meant to protect the white community, they were also helping stir a fear within the white community that there would be a retaliation or retribution by the Black community. And so they had that additional fear factor built into what these patrols were doing. So everyone is exhausted. The women in the community had coffee patrols themselves. They were fixing coffee for the men on the blocks and providing breakfasts for these men. So everyone was tense. Everyone was tired in the white community. In the Black community, we don't have as many records about what they were thinking, doing, and how they were existing. But you have to understand that they too were tense. They too understood that this was a sea change and that something was happening that was not going to bode well for the future.
To kind of put a point on it for this episode, it was a city where both the white and Black communities were expecting the possibility of violence and they were preparing for it.
Yes. The red shirt rallies, the patrols, everyone was armed in the white community. African-American community had guns as well, but not at the level and degree of the white community. And the churches were working to ensure that their parishioners were cared for and understood what was going on. But I don't think anybody understood or was prepared for what happened on November 10th.
Well, we will leave it there, because Larae is going to join us again for our second episode, where we pick up on the morning of November 10th and talk about those events from sunup to sundown. But before we leave, I want to give Jan a chance to talk a little bit about the efforts that the Cape Fear Museum have recently published to chart the events of 1898 with an interactive map. So Jan, where can people find this?
Yeah, if they go to our website, which is www.capefearmuseum.com, we've put it under our online exhibits, and it's called a story map, and it plots some of the events both big picture kind of political context and then sort of what happens on the 8th, the 9th, the 10th, a lot of it drawn from the work that Larrey did and then supplemented with some other material. But it really is interactive and fairly easy to use tool that can help you better understand the way that these events unfolded on our landscape and in our city.
It's a great resource. I used it when I was researching this episode and this series. And so I'd encourage everyone to go and look at it. Jan, thank you so much for coming on this episode and joining Larrey and I and Chris. And thank you to Chris again, who had to jump off. But thank you for coming on. But Jan, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, it was really enjoyable to spend time with you and Larrey and Chris.
And Larrey, I will see you back here for our second episode very soon. Thank you for coming on and welcome to Cape Fear and Earth. I know this is your first time.
You're welcome. This has been great. Look forward to more discussions.
Thanks, everyone.
That's it for the first episode of Unearthing 1898. Thank you so much for joining me. And a big thank you to our guest, Larrey Umfleet, Jan Davidson, and Chris Fonville. We'll be back tomorrow, November 10th, for part two of our series, in which we will detail the events of the massacre and coup on their 122nd anniversary. And then we will close out our series on November 11th with our third and final episode. Until then, please make sure that you're a member of our Facebook group, where listeners can ask questions about our episodes and share their own memories of the region's history. In that group, I post extra content for each of our episodes and all of my coverage of local history for the Star News. You can find that group by searching Cape Fear Unearthed on Facebook. If you have episode ideas or questions about the show, you can also email me directly at capefearunearthed@gmail.com. And don't forget to sign up for the Cape Fear Unearthed newsletter, which goes out every week. Sign up for that newsletter at starnewsonline.com/newsletters. As always, you can get a list of all the books, articles, and resources used in researching this podcast in the show notes of each episode. Cape Fear Unearthed was written, edited, and hosted by me, Hunter Ingram. You can find more of my work at starnewsonline.com, or you can follow me on Twitter, @Hunter_Wesley. Additional editing for the show is done by Adam Fish. This podcast is made possible by listeners and readers like you. Support local journalism and Cape Fear Unearthed by subscribing to the Star News today at starnewsonline.com/subscribe. And while you're subscribing to things, be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcast or wherever you get the show so you never miss an episode. And while you're there, leave us a review, which will help more people find Cape Fear Unearthed. Until our next episode, get out and explore the Cape Fear region on your own. You never know what you might unearth.